Palestine. Occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
Our journalists are doing very important work that is exposing Israel's crimes, that is helping shift public opinion across the world. And for that, Israel has very obvious interests to eliminate this voice.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Butu. For over 120 days, Israel has been carrying out a genocidal attack against the Palestinian people in Gaza. Over this period, Israel has killed and injured over 100,000 Palestinians in Gaza alone, with at least 7,000 Palestinians still missing and presumed dead under the rubble. This includes Israel killing 123 Palestinian journalists. In this episode, we dive deeper into Israel's deliberate targeting and killing of Palestinian journalists in the Gaza Strip, who've been exposing Israel's brutality against Palestinians. Journalists in the Gaza Strip work under the most difficult conditions, trying to provide the world with images of Israel's genocidal actions. Owing to more than 16 years of blockade, foreign journalists need special permission to enter the Gaza Strip and, as a result, rarely go there. And unlike foreign journalists, Palestinian journalists are not only risking their lives to share the story, but themselves are living this genocide, with Israel turning them and their families into targets. According to the United Nations, Gaza is the deadliest place in the world for journalists right now, with more journalists killed in the Gaza Strip than were killed during the Second World War. Israel has a long history of killing Palestinian journalists, from assassinating Palestinian journalist Ghassan Kanafani in 1972, to murdering renowned journalist Shirin Abu Akleh in 2022. Israeli attacks on journalists are not new. On October the 25th, Israel killed the wife and two children of Al Jazeera journalist Wael Dahdour. 70 days later, Israel assassinated Wael's son Hamza Dahdour, who is also a journalist in Gaza, killing Hamza alongside his colleague Mustafa Thuraya. Israeli forces also killed Wael's cameraman, Samir Awdakka, injuring Wael in the process. Wael, along with other Palestinian journalists such as Mu'taz Azaizi and Plasti Al-Aqad, have left the Gaza Strip for safety or for medical treatment. Those who remain behind remain targets as Israel attempts to silence their work. To hear more about these attacks, I speak with Anan Kuzmar, a representative from the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate, who talks about the conditions under which Palestinian journalists are working and who stresses the need to amplify the voices of these brave journalists. Thank you for listening. Welcome, Anan. Welcome to the This is Palestine podcast, and thanks for joining us. I wanted to begin by asking if you can briefly let us know and tell us about the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate. What is it and why did you get involved in it?
The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate is the only union that represents Palestinian journalists in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. And our membership is also open to Palestinian journalists wherever they are. But we mostly work with those in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I joined the Journalist Syndicate as a volunteer on the 18th of October because I had already started working with them on an investigation about the strike at Al Ahli Hospital. And from then, I also, from just being in the office, noticing the trend or the pattern of targeting of Palestinian journalists. And remember, this is 10 days in already. Journalists being receiving threats and then being killed within very short period. So So I got involved in the advocacy team for the syndicate. We're a small team, and we're doing stuff that way beyond the capacity, the usual capacity of the syndicate. So a lot of the violations that usually would be recorded by the syndicate are no longer being recorded in the same way. For example, the syndicate has recorded 9,000 violations against Palestinian journalists over the last 10 years. But many of these violations, the same type of violations that are happening today, are not even being recorded in the same manner because of the huge escalation. And initially, we failed to get any media attention to this issue, which was, to be honest with you, was and still very baffling for us. We do not understand it. We do not understand how the world is watching this. People who should be outraged and alarmed about what is happening to Palestinian journalists in Gaza, organizations that are mandated, their whole purpose is to protect press freedom and the freedom and the safety of journalists, have not shown anywhere near the required action or positions. But we started to look into different opportunities, and an opportunity arise with the lawsuit that was filed by the DCI against Biden and U.S. officials for their continued support for Israel's genocidal military campaign. And the lawsuit seeks to block this diplomatic and military support for Israel. And we saw the targeting of journalists as one of the ways to support this case, but also shed more light on the targeted and calculated element and the goals behind it through the assassination of Palestinian journalists. The amicus brief at the time had numbers up to 19th of December. We investigated all the cases, or I updated the numbers regarding the number of journalists who were killed. At the time, there were 109 journalists who were killed by Israeli strikes. And out of those 109, 96 at least were specifically targeted. Out of the 96, 22 were killed in the line of duty, where their location was known to the Israeli military. They were wearing all the protective gear that is clearly marked with press and all of this. And despite this, they were targeted. And based on the information we gathered on all of those 22 cases, there was no reason to believe that there was any other target, or that the journalists were somehow killed as a side effect for a strike that targeted somebody else. And the remaining and the most common case of Palestinian journalists being killed by Israel in Gaza over the last 3 months is journalists being targeted at home while with their families. And we looked into, again, all the cases, and most of the time these strikes were targeting the journalists at home with only their family members, and these cases have been widely reported. In many other cases, there's been other people in the flats, as obviously our journalists, like many in Gaza, are either displaced from their homes and they end up in other people's houses, or they are hosting other families in their home. So this made the investigations a little bit more tricky in these cases, but we did look through the names of everybody who was killed and tried to establish their connection and why they were in the flat, or if they were in the flat at the time with their family. And for extra safety, we excluded any cases that the number of those killed in the strike were above 10. Even if, for us, we have enough context to understand why these people were in the same place. And we just decided that maybe that is maybe too far to suggest, and possibly there is another target, but we do not know. But I think it's important to highlight our attacks on journalists, which is a layer of the Gaza society that is around, we estimate, 1,200 journalists at the time of the start of the war, is quite a representative number. And it shows that the number of people that we think were not targeted, or we cannot establish if they have been targeted, is actually a very small percentage. So a lot of those people were killed deliberately and in a calculated manner.
So, Hanan, what you're saying from the numbers is that about 10% of all Palestinian journalists in the Gaza Strip have been killed in this genocide that Israel is committing. And of course, this isn't the first time that Israel has killed journalists. It's for many, many, many years. They've also killed journalists in the West Bank as well. Perhaps the most famous that most people know of is, of course, Shirin Abu Akleh, who was killed in May of 2022. Why is it, Hanan, that you think that Israel is targeting Palestinian journalists?
There is two main things to think about in this context. The first thing, our journalists are doing very important work that is exposing Israel's crimes, that is helping shift public opinion across the world. And for that, Israel has very obvious interest to eliminate this voice. And also relevant to this, the fact that many Palestinians in Gaza look at these journalists as a portal to the world, a portal of hope. And Israel is trying to destroy Palestinian presence in Gaza in all its aspects, and killing hope is a high priority in this regard. But also, we are seeing a trend where, on the long term, clearly Israel is trying to eliminate a layer of Palestinian voices, to put it this way. And this extends beyond journalists. If you look at the profiles, like I said, you notice that they are approaching or they are targeting people who have potential to rebuild this community. Their voices are very important. They have been important. These are the people who have paid heavy prices even before the last 3 months. So there were a layer of society who have been putting their comfort on the line, willing to pay a price for the collective good. And it is easy to see why Israel would want to target such a layer. So on top of journalists, there are lecturers, heads of universities, poets, writers, community activists, feminists, even social media influencers. And even amongst the journalists themselves, if you look at most media lecturers in Gaza have been targeted. Most journalists who are writers or poets have been targeted. The media has picked up on these people as journalists, but they are actually part of a wider society that Israel is trying to eliminate. Unfortunately, such is the level of destruction and desperate situation that exists in Gaza now, we are not even fully aware of some of these elements.
You point to a very important statement that the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate put out, and yet another reason that journalists, I think, is important for people to understand, another reason that Palestinian journalists have been targeted is because they are the only voice right now that's in Gaza. There are no foreign journalists that are in the Gaza Strip. And the work that Palestinian journalists are doing is not only professional and some of the finest journalism that at least I've ever seen, but it ties to the statement that you, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate, put out, which is that these journalists are not only reporting the news, but they're also living through this genocide. Can you share a little bit more with our listeners about this?
Before I go into this, I think there is also like another relevant point to what you just said. If you look at even most recent cases, Mustafa Abu Rayya. Mustafa Abu Rayya was one of very few last skilled media drone operators in Gaza. These people have played a prominent role in documenting the level of destruction that has been caused by the Israeli genocidal military campaign. And he was targeted. And last night, the Israeli military had the audacity to release fabricated documents aiming to tarnish his reputation and the reputation of journalism in general, justify his targeting and the targeting of other very important voices, despite the fact that Mustafa, like many other of our journalists, are actually well celebrated around the world. Many of those journalists who were killed and found themselves on the CPG list of journalists killed this year had been writing for the CPG for many years. Now they find themselves as a name. They made a name for themselves, documented violations against press freedom in Gaza. This is the immediate goal of the Israeli military campaign, is to silence Palestinian voices and to justify and facilitate its genocide against the people of Gaza. You asked about the personal stories, and this is really difficult for me, really, I have no words for some of the things that the conversations or the situations I know about. So basically, in our communication with naturally, the first line of contact for us in Gaza is our journalists. So when one journalist is assassinated, we tend, obviously, to contact journalists' friends of theirs. And the first reaction we get is, we're not going to do this anymore, reflecting the immediate danger that these people find themselves in. Another thing that we hear time and time again, that these people are struggling to find places to live. They are struggling for many reasons. One of the reasons is they are recognized as a potential target for the Israeli army, and therefore they are a threat to their immediate surrounding, and the fact that they carry this guilt with them. Many of our journalists in the last days had to decide who amongst their family they wish to maybe put their lives in danger, or another way to think about it is to go with them. These are the sort of decisions that people are having to make right now. We have, at the moment, 25 journalists in Gaza who have been injured, majority of them, by the Israeli military campaign, waiting for urgent medical care, for preventable, or for for injuries that they can recover from completely. Yet they do not have access to healthcare because Israel destroyed the health system in Gaza and is preventing Palestinians who are in need of urgent medical healthcare to access it anywhere outside Gaza. You think also about the journalists who lost family members to continue their work despite knowing that maybe their work was behind this. You do not see what you expect with the Gaza journalists. The one thing that is remarkable about them is they never complain. Even when they are sharing their personal stories, they are telling us because they want the world to know, and they want the situation for the people of Gaza to change. They are sharing their personal stories as a way to help the collective. And that's all they seem to care about. And that puts a lot of obligation, I guess, on all of us to heed to the call and do all we can to stop this.
Some of the most moving things that I've seen since Israel's attack began, one of the things that we all saw was the way in which Wael al-Dahdour from Al Jazeera, the day after his wife and two children and grandchild were killed, that he continued to report. And when his colleague, Samer Abadaka, was killed, continued to report. And then when his son, Hamzi, was also killed, that he continued to report. Also privately, I can tell you, and you've also had these same conversations with our same friends about friends who tell us that they never thought that they would be the news because their job is to report the news, and now they've become the news because they themselves have been displaced or their homes have been bombed or Israel has bombed and killed members of their family. And so this, you just feel this heavy weight that these journalists are carrying and that they're passing on to us to then pick up that to do the work that they can't do any longer. So what is it that we can be doing to protect Palestinian journalists and to also get these stories out, to get these voices out and to get their work known?
Yeah, I think this is a very important question that I wish I could give an answer, an individual answer for every listener. But the reality is everybody knows their context better than anybody else outside. I encourage everybody to try and find yourself in a collective group doing stuff rather than doing it individually. Recognize the skills that you have and the knowledge that you have and see where you fit most, not what you want to do most. The situation is urgent now, but we need to continue to do this for the people of Gaza, but also for justice and accountability in Palestine long term. So we need people to be prepared to stay in tune with us and continue to do important work. And I think in this context, the voices of Palestinian journalists in Gaza as a portal for our people in Gaza is also very relevant. We've seen over the last 3 months numerous shameful examples of people trying to grift off the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza. But I think it's important to point out to those who are more well-informed and have a more nuanced understanding of the situation to actually reach out to our new supporters who may be falling victim to those who actually do not have the best interest of Gaza in the long term at heart and who are mostly getting involved at the moment because they can have short-term benefit.
And Hanan, it sounds as though you are saying what many of us have been saying for quite some time, which is to uplift Palestinian voices, the voices of the people who are risking their lives and taking these pictures, taking the videos, who are writing the stories, who are sharing their experiences, because it is these people who the focus should be on. And in a way, the more that we focus on them, we might actually be able to protect them in a way. The last question I wanted to ask you is, do you think that Israel will ever be held to account for killing all of these journalists?
I think this is a very important question to us, really, to us Palestinians in the first place, and I think to our supporters in the second place. I think if anybody had any illusions before the last 3 months about where, you know, the divisions or the lines on this battle should be drawn, then you need to wake up. We need to be the drivers and engines for this accountability. We cannot wait for organizations, governments, or any form of institutions that proclaim to want to uphold human rights. So many of these voices have been exposed over the last 3 months. So now we need to work on the new assumption that we have to do it despite them, not heed for their support, but try and force them into holding Israel accountable. And we need to hold Israel accountable from our end first so that the domino effect can actually happen and the snowballing can happen. I think the potential is there. I also think that in those dark times, this is the sort of thing that is keeping the spirits of our people going, not just in Gaza, wherever they are, in the West Bank, in 48, and all over the world. And I think soon enough, Palestinians, wherever they are, they will realize their collective interest to hold Israel to account. And now we have also a new platform where most of the world is with us in the idea that accountability is a prerequisite to any future solution, not an obstacle. And any future solution that does not go through accountability is a bypass to international law, a bypass to any legitimate and just solution to the situation. And this bypass has been tried before and has led us here. So We need to spin our way out of this circle. And we need to put accountability as the first step and a prerequisite for any future diplomatic or otherwise solution.
Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the IMEU. Please don't forget to subscribe. I'm Deanna Butu. Thanks for listening.
The plans for the West Bank can't be seen in separation from the plans of the Gaza Strip. Even from the beginning of the war, people were talking about pushing the Palestinians of Gaza out into Sinai and re-establishing settlements again. This is not different at all from what's happening in the West Bank and what they are planning for the West Bank or what they would like to happen in the West Bank, expanding more settlements and kicking out more Palestinians. This is all part of the same struggle. It's part of the same colonization effort.
From Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, I am Yara Hawari, and this is Rethinking Palestine. Since the assault on Gaza, which began in October 2023, tens of thousands of Palestinians have been killed, injured, or are missing, likely buried under the rubble of their own homes or shelters. Nearly 2 million Palestinians in Gaza have been displaced, with cold, thirst, and hunger ravaging the entire population. While the world deliberates on the technicalities of genocide, Israeli colonization of the West Bank and disruption to Palestinian life has only accelerated. Joining me in this episode is Fathi Nimr, Shabaka's very own Palestine Policy Fellow. Fathi, thank you for joining me on Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you for having me, Yara.
So Fathi, perhaps you can tell us a little bit about what the Israeli regime is doing on the ground in the West Bank at the moment.
Well, the Israeli regime has been really going on an absolutely barbaric rampage in the West Bank from the side of military raids and arrests. We're talking about almost 400 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since the 7th of October, and thousands have been injured. They seem to be taking out their frustrations really on Palestinians for the events in Gaza and shooting anyone for any reason. I mean, in the early stages of the war, we heard terrifying stories about torture of Palestinians, humiliation, even urinating on them. Of course, before October 7, there were minimal or no consequences to such behavior, but now it seems like normalized as a way of revenge against Palestinians. The settlers have also been going on a rampage. They seem to be now emboldened to go out and do whatever they want. They have been armed by the government. Thousands of assault rifles were distributed to them, so they now feel that they have the backing of everybody to just go out and do whatever they want. They've been burning down orchards and threatening Palestinians. The number of Palestinians arrested has skyrocketed. We're talking about almost 6,000 today in the last 4 months. For example, Palestinian laborers inside the Israeli labor market have been banned from entry because all of their permits have been revoked. And there have been some sanctions on the Palestinian Authority by way of withholding the tax returns, which is supposedly a right of the Palestinian Authority to take from Israel. And this has also closed down transportation. There's difficulties exporting, importing, and people just getting to work or people just trying to access universities, for example, has been very difficult to move between areas. So this is, in general, some of the biggest actions taken by the Israeli occupation since October 7th in the West Bank.
And of course, that difficulty in movement is because of the extra roadblocks and checkpoints that the Israeli army has set up across the West Bank. I read somewhere that there are now more checkpoints than there were during the Second Intifada.
The close down of the West Bank has been really extreme. Now, of course, before October, we had villages, for example, in the southeast Nablus area who had their main entrances forced shut so that the Palestinian traffic is segregated from settler traffic. But today, even routes that are usually open have been completely sealed, and new checkpoints have been introduced in areas that had never existed before, like you said, even before the Second Intifada. So a routine like 30-minute drive could take up to an hour and a half now, depending on where you're going. And this has been very noticeable around the villages around Ramallah as well.
And now, Fatih, you mentioned the withholding of the Palestinian tax revenue by the Israeli regime. It's worth mentioning for our listeners that under the Paris Protocol, which was the sort of economic annex of the Oslo Accords in 1994, the protocol stipulated that the Israeli regime would collect the tax revenues on behalf of the PA until it achieved statehood. And the Israeli regime has systematically used that as leverage to collectively punish the PA, to collectively punish Palestinians. And so, again, we see that being used in the West Bank, but also for public servants in Gaza. So many Palestinians who work in the public sector are actually not getting their full salaries. And I think it was estimated that the Israeli regime is withholding around $188 million a month, which accounts for about 64% of the PA authority's total revenue.
I think things like this, such as the economic angle or the bureaucratic angle of such, it usually gets left behind, understandably, because of the genocide going in Gaza and of the deaths and the killings going on in the West Bank. But this is like the systemic effects of the occupation, how it operates. It's also very violent and very colonial. So the design of the economy of the West Bank from day one has been designed in a way that it could be held hostage by Israel, like at the drop of a hat. And this is what they really succeeded with. Now we have about 170,000 laborers that have been cut up from their income. We have PA workers who are around 140,000 between civilian and security sectors who depend on these tax returns to be able to be paid their salaries. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people basically having their income either cut or disrupted. Difficulties exporting or importing means that companies simply can't function as normal. And even if they could, the indirect damage is that people simply have less money to buy anything. So nobody has really remained unaffected from the economic aspects and these measures taken by Israel. And this is not the first time, of course, that this happened. Whenever something that Israel is unhappy about happens, they withhold the tax returns. And we saw this during the Second Intifada. They operated that quite frequently, and it would not be uncommon for people to go out months without any kind of income.
So Fatih, we're seeing a severe economic impact. We're seeing increased military raids, mass incarceration. We're also seeing extrajudicial assassinations. Why is all of this going under the radar? Why is this not being reported on by the mainstream media?
It's sort of understandable in a way. The genocide currently being carried out against Gaza is on such a monstrous scale, with so many stories of cruelty, mass murder, and really the unfiltered imagery that's coming out of it. Like, this is one of the most documented genocides out there when it comes to social media. And it's kind of impossible not for that to take precedence over what's going on here in the West Bank. So this is part of the reason why Israelis and, I mean, settlers, armies, all the components of their society, they thought it would be a golden opportunity to go out and just do whatever they want. And settlers in particular have really been reaping this now that they're much more emboldened with their more open support anyway by the state. They've been going out and expelling Palestinians from their communities. We're talking about entire Bedouin communities that no longer exist, especially in the Hebron area. They go, they burn their crops, they kill their livestock, and they tell them if they don't leave, their entire family is going to be killed tomorrow. And this has been the case. We have over 1,000 people that have been expelled from over 13 communities in the southern West Bank. And threats of a second Nakba or a great Nakba, this has become routine from the settlers, you know, from a society that usually denies the Nakba. But now it's something to be called for and cherished and kind of like galvanized for. So I really think that this the genocide happening in Gaza is being used as a cover by these settlers and the army to do whatever they want in the West Bank with much less scrutiny than usual. I mean, usually there isn't that much scrutiny to begin with, but now they can get away with, they think they get away with really anything they want to do. So none of these plans are really new, but this is the timing that they chose because they think that people are less likely to notice.
Yeah, and of course, the devastation in Gaza is ongoing and so horrific. It makes sense that reporting on that would take precedence. But I do think, especially in the mainstream Western media, that there is a more insidious aspect to this. I think it's about isolating Gaza from the rest of Palestine. It's about framing this as a war between Hamas and Israel rather than an acceleration in the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And that's why there is limited reporting on what's happening in the West Bank, because it's kind of a compartmentalization or a dividing of Palestine to separate Gaza and sort of make it seem like an isolated issue rather than really the core of the Palestinian struggle.
I agree. I think that the compartmentalization of Palestine and its different regions is a very serious issue, and it is employed in such a manner. The plans for the West Bank can't be seen in separation from the plans of the Gaza Strip. I mean, even from the beginning of the war, people were talking about pushing the people, the Palestinians of Gaza, out into Sinai and making re-establishing settlements again. This is not very different at all from what's happening in the West Bank and what they are planning for the West Bank, or what they would like to happen in the West Bank, expanding more settlements and kicking out more Palestinians. This is all part of the same, struggle. It's part of the same colonization efforts. We can't look at it separately from what's going on, even in Jerusalem or even within 48. It's all connected. And I think one of the biggest successes, really, of the occupation of 67 is that it's really tried to reinforce these kind of segmentation of Palestinian society and to kind of make this a fact of life and a natural part, rather than it being something imposed on us very recently.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work. So Fatih, what has been the global policy reaction to the things that are unfolding in the West Bank?
We know when it comes to Gaza, for example, we haven't seen anything concrete. We have the usual calls to respect human rights. And if something is like really bad, they're like, we're concerned about the human rights situation. But when it comes to the West Bank, it feels like they're a little bit more brave to talk about the situation. Relatively speaking, obviously, it's not great, but relatively speaking, they feel like they can talk about the situation a bit more because it can't be seen as support for Hamas, but rather for the Palestinian Authority, which has been doing its best to remain in the good graces of its benefactors. Like when it comes to the West Bank, it's easy to say, these are just radical fringe settlers, treat them as isolated incidents, and absolutely ignore how they can't exist without government support and resources. And of course, not criticize the official quote unquote military action carried out by the occupation forces. So I think very little has been done. But recently, we heard about this Biden step to sanction settlers. So he made it crystal clear, Biden, that he refuses to put any red lines on Israel and Gaza. So to try and appease, in my view, some of his Muslim or Arab base in the U.S. during the election season, I think he basically tried to throw people a bone. And he said he's going to sanction extremist settlers who attack Palestinians. And of course, all of that ended up to being somehow four people. I don't really think that this is a very meaningful step. The practicalities of it are completely unclear. Are they going to use Israeli police data? Because that will never happen. They aren't going to cooperate. Are they going to use Palestinian testimonies? I don't think that they're going to rely on that either. It just seems like a very weak step, trying to like appear like they're doing something, because they're absolutely not doing anything in Gaza other than, of course, supporting the genocide. If you wanted to make any real statement, he maybe would have sanctioned all settlers as a whole, but that would have been more impactful. But again, I don't think that's the actual goal, actually pressuring Israel. I think it's just to try to salvage some of his image after his open support for the Gaza genocide. Of course, the Israelis are making a big deal out of it. They're making it seem much more significant than it actually is. But this is, generally how Israel acts. Even someone like Obama, who signed one of the biggest military support packages in history, was called anti-Israel because one time he criticized Israel without actually, doing any follow-up or any action for it. But this is how it usually goes.
So, Fatih, let's switch gears a bit and focus on the Palestinian Authority and its response to the ongoing genocide in Gaza.
Well, the Palestinian Authority, it's basically been acting almost like a neutral third country. It claims that it's doing diplomatic work behind the scenes, but I don't really take that claim with a grain of salt. And even so, if that's the entirety of its reaction, it's completely inadequate in the current moment. I wish it were only relegated to that. I mean, it's actually killed four Palestinians for protesting against it during the genocide. People were out in the street in what started as a support for Gaza protest, and then it became an TPA protest, as it usually does, because they were basically not doing anything. It was repressed quite harshly, as is the habit of the PA, and in multiple of these protests, around four Palestinians have been killed. Then it doesn't just stop there. There are reports that the PA has actually instructed its schools, the official government schools, to not even mention anything about Gaza since October, or anything having to do with resistance. They're absolutely terrified of being in any way seen to be in collusion or in support of Hamas or the Palestinians in Gaza in anything that's going on. And I think they're really in a tough position because their project is kind of falling apart. Palestinian youth, for example, overwhelmingly see the PA as this corrupt subcontractor for the occupation. They've lived their entire lives under this paradigm of two states and Oslo, but they have not seen anything really from it. This magical state they've been hearing about since they were born is no more real today than it was a decade or two ago. So basically the PA has nothing to show for itself. And any kind of victory for Hamas in Gaza, such as, let's say, the release of prisoners, even if it's not all of them, or even a symbolic victory, it's a huge blow to their two states project, which for most people living today haven't really seen it produce anything tangible in the past two decades. It's just all talk to them. So I feel like while they outright can't say in public that they hope Hamas loses, I imagine that this is the general sentiment there. And I feel like the people understand this and they sense this. And it's never been more obvious that the PA has become a subcontractor for the occupation in a way that is not even under the table anymore, that it used to be at least.
Fateh, what about discussions about the PA taking over Gaza? I know that's something that the Americans are very keen on and have been in talks with the PA about this. And of course, as we're talking, you know, the genocide is ongoing. We're not even in a post stage. This is still, you know, an active genocide. And rather remarkably, people are talking about the day after, even while the bombs are still falling on our kin in Gaza. But there are those discussions happening between the PA and various different actors. What are your thoughts on that?
As you said, I think all talk about the day after is not only premature, I think a lot of it is almost delusional because they're plotting for something that they don't even know how it's going to unfold. Like, they are all so confident that they're going to dismantle Hamas and everything is going to be like, I don't know what they imagine it's going to be like. So the idea of the PA going in on the back of an Israeli tank would be absolutely terrible for everyone involved, including the PA itself, because that would be the last nail in its last shred of any kind of legitimacy ever had, even though some would argue it doesn't have any left. I mean, the PA has said as much. They said we don't want to enter Gaza on the back of an Israeli tank, but it seems like they're being pushed towards that direction because realistically, who really is going to, from the eyes of the Americans and the Israelis, I mean, who's going to take over Gaza after Hamas? I mean, Israel says that it wants to occupy. Some people are suggesting international forces. I think it's all, like, again, like, delusional to be talking about this right now. But I think if it were not for the optics, I think the PA would jump at this opportunity to be able to retake Gaza. But I don't think they would be able to pull that off in the current situation.
And what about the response of the Palestinian street in the West Bank, ordinary Palestinians? Obviously, Palestine is a very small community. We are connected on multiple different levels with our brothers and sisters in Gaza, family ties, friendship, colleagues. This has been an incredibly traumatic time for the Palestinian people as a whole. But I think there have been questions as to the lack of mobilization in the West Bank and perhaps more specifically in Ramallah. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's an overwhelming feeling that nobody's doing anything enough and that everything pales really in front of what the Palestinians in Gaza are giving. Like, this is not to discount the entirety of the West Bank, obviously, because it has given hundreds of martyrs and there are thousands of prisoners and almost 12,000 injured in the West Bank only since October. Like, groups in refugee camps, for example, are bearing the brunt of the armed resistance. I feel like people are really demobilized in the West Bank, at least in Ramallah, in a way that they're very worried, actually, about the repression from the Palestinian Authority. And it's really horrible that we've reached this place that even, for example, printing presses, they are not willing to print posters that have anything on them anymore about resistance or even boycotts. I remember when we tried to get some boycott stickers done, they were like, no, we don't want to do that. We don't want to get into anything political. This is a Palestinian printing house. Like, this is where people used to go and overwhelmingly print thousands upon thousands of martyr posters and things like that. We have been completely almost domesticated. I think it's a combination of political repression and also the huge economic control that Israel has over us. And over the last few months, it's become so obvious that the economy of the West Bank is completely held hostage by the Israeli regime and that there is absolutely no way you can have, you know, a normal life unless you, one way or another, kind of acquiesce to the status quo. And this is something very dangerous that the Palestinians have been driven to over 20 years of this state building project. Where this was a very aimed for result. This is not something that just happened. And this is also not only witnessed in the West Bank. You can see this also in Jerusalem and in within 48. There's a huge kind of repression and atomization of Palestinians to kind of demobilize them and make it seem that any word that you say could come back to haunt you and you will be out of a job, you'll be out of even deported if you're in 48 or in Jerusalem. So this is some of the situation that people in the West Bank, obviously, what we're doing is not enough. Like, people are trying to contribute from the little niche that they have, like journalists, for example, or lawyers trying to support the ICJ case as much as possible. But this is like, it doesn't do anything compared to what's going on in Gaza. So it's a very difficult situation. And it's very sad that we've reached this point of demobilization.
Indeed, this is a tragic moment, but also I think a pivotal one for the Palestinian people. Fatih, thank you so much for sharing your insights with me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Shabaka has just published a roundtable on this very topic with contributions from Fatih and other members of the Policy Network. It's available on our website, al-shabaka.org. Thank you for listening to this episode of Rethinking Palestine. Rethinking Palestine is brought to you by Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. Ashabaka is the only global independent Palestinian think tank whose mission is to produce critical policy analysis and collectively imagine a new policy-making paradigm for Palestine and Palestinians worldwide. For more information or to donate to support our work, visit al-shabaka.org. And importantly, don't forget to subscribe to Rethinking Palestine wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to damning new projections about the health crisis unfolding in Gaza. In a minute, we'll be joined by one of the lead authors of a joint report from the London School of Hygiene and Johns Hopkins University, which found, quote, even in the best-case ceasefire scenario, thousands of excess deaths would continue to occur, mainly due to the time it would take to improve water sanitation and shelter conditions, reduce malnutrition, and restore functioning healthcare services in Gaza, unquote. In an interview with CNN last week, the regional emergency director of the World Health Organization, Dr. Richard Brennan, was asked about the report's projections.
This study is absolutely striking. I don't know how many wake-up calls we need to alert us to the dire, absolutely dire and desperate situation on the ground. We've already lost 29,000 people from traumatic injuries. We already have over 70,000 others that have survived injuries, with some terrible injuries. I was in Gaza last week. You can't imagine the deformities, the limb losses of young children, young adolescents, young adults who are going to be left with these disabilities for years to come. We don't know how many people have died because they didn't get access to their blood pressure medicines or their diabetic treatment and so on. But we know, we suspect that thousands more have died unnecessarily because of lack of access to health care. And now you have these two reputable institutions. I know the two study leaders. No one is better placed to do these kind of estimates than these two institutions. And now we're saying if things continue, if we see this escalation, if we see this military operation into Rafah, we're going to be looking at an extra 80-odd thousand deaths in 6 months' time. If that's not a wake-up call, I don't know what is.
That was the World Health Organization's Regional Emergency Director, Dr. Richard Brennan. For more, we're joined in London by Zeina Jamaluddin. She's a nutritionist, an epidemiologist, one of the lead authors of this new joint report from the London School of Hygiene and Johns Hopkins titled Crisis in Gaza, Scenario-Based Health Impact Projections. She's a research fellow at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Zeina, welcome to Democracy Now! Thanks so much for joining us. Just lay out your findings.
Hello, welcome. So as that was just mentioned, in fact, we have attempted to actually project what would be the excess mortality in different scenarios in Gaza. In fact, we know that there is the direct effect of the war, but however, we also wanted to understand what is the indirect effect of the war on infectious diseases, for example, mortality from COVID-19, increased excess mortality from maternal and newborn healthcare because they're not able to access health services, increased mortality due to the chronic diseases for specifically type 1 diabetic patient, people with chronic kidney diseases, and how much excess mortality would happen due to this. We also modeled the impact of acute malnutrition, which is what was just mentioned right now in terms of how much wasting or thin children would increase as an underlying factor to all of this excess death. So what, with this attempt, we actually find that in case of a ceasefire, around 6,000 to 11,000 lives would actually be dead and would have an excess death in the case of a ceasefire of around 11,000 deaths. In case of an escalation, we'd see around 85,000 deaths, which is currently what's happening in Rafah and in the next 6 months. But also what's important to point out is in case of a ceasefire now, we would be saving around 75,000 lives.
Can you respond to this latest news of the two-month-old baby boy, the Palestinian child, who died on Friday of starvation?
Yes, of course. So basically, before the war, we know that in terms of wasting, which is means that thin children, the prevalence or the level in Gaza was around 3%. The majority of the population in Gaza was heavily reliant on food assistance. This was 77% of the population relied on assistance coming in. With the current food trucks being very limited coming into Gaza, we actually modeled the decrease in the food availability currently in Gaza, the decrease in agricultural land available in Gaza, but also the decrease in the food truck coming into Gaza to actually understand what is the caloric intake that is happening currently, to understand the increase in malnutrition or wasting. What we project, in fact, is that on to date, we see a prevalence of around 12% of children under five that are wasting. We would also project that the next few months, in the case of an escalation, this would reach to 26%, which is classified as catastrophic. In the next 6 months, the prevalence would reach 50%. So basically, responding to what you're saying, we're actually currently starting to see the critical phase of acute malnutrition being portrayed.
What would solve this, Zeina?
A ceasefire, first of all. A significant increase in food access, whether it's also through airdrops and through basically allowing all the food trucks and also medical aid to come in without any restrictions.
I wanted to ask you about how casualties are prefaced, especially in the Western media. Your piece for The Lancet in November is titled Excess Mortality in Gaza, October 7th to 26, 2023. So many news media in the West preface casualty figures by saying, quote, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, which is run by Hamas, which has led so many to question the veracity of the figures. What did you find?
So when the Ministry of Health has released the first listing of people who were killed during October, we, as epidemiologists, took this data and actually analyzed to understand what is happening in terms of duplication and the accuracy of the data. We have analyzed it as London School separately, but also Hopkins University has analyzed it, and we both find that there is no reason to actually doubt the accuracy of this data. There's another aspect of it all to say that in previous war, the Ministry of Health data has been validated and basically from different independent sources. At the same time, this is the same system that the Ministry of Health has used previously for COVID-19 reporting or other mortality estimation and reporting. So it's important to note that this didn't start at the beginning of the war of reporting mortality. And so they relied on this system. But we did assess the accuracy, and we find no reason to doubt these data sets or the numbers reported by the Ministry of Health.
Well, Zeina Jamaluddin, we want to thank you so much for being with us, nutritionist and epidemiologist, one of the lead authors of the new joint report from the London School of Hygiene and Johns Hopkins titled Crisis in Gaza, Scenario-Based Health Impact Projections. She's a research fellow at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. We'll link to that report.
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity radio show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Let's do it again. What's going on, people? My name is Boca Floja from Quilombo Arte, all the way from Mexico City via New York. Sigan escuchando CKUT 90.3 FM.
Heavy Trip and CKUT present an evening with Revenge International recording artists Horse Lords and Colbert. a new Grammy double whammy. Chock-a-block with sonic tomfoolery. Live at Sotrania on Saturday, March 16th. Tickets on sale now. For more information, visit www.google.com.
Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked at the CKT 90.3 FM.
Something that can make you do wrong, make you do right. Yeah. Love.